From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The war in Ukraine is about to enter a new phase as the Ukrainian military is preparing to launch an offensive against Russia, though that seems to be on a temporary hold, at least for now. Listen to what President Volodymyr Zelensky told European public broadcasters last week, speaking here through a translator.
Mentally, we're ready. In terms of how motivated our military are, we're ready. In terms of enough personnel in our brigades, we're ready. In terms of equipment, not everything has arrived yet. That's my answer.
So you're still waiting for weapons and for the kind of military equipment that you've been promised to arrive?
Yes, we're still expecting some things. They will reinforce our counteroffensive. And most importantly, they will protect our people. We're expecting armored vehicles. They arrive in batches. We can advance with what we've got, and I think we can be successful. But we will lose a lot of people. I think that is unacceptable. We need to wait. We need a bit more time.
Zelensky also made a diplomatic tour of Europe last week, visiting with the Pope and the leaders of Germany, France, and Britain. Meanwhile, back in Ukraine, attacks are still a fact of life. Last weekend, as the Ukrainian duo in the Eurovision Song Contest was set to take the stage, their hometown of Ternopil was targeted by a Russian missile strike, hitting a warehouse and destroying or damaging a dozen homes. Then yesterday, there was a barrage of missiles and drones targeting Kyiv. Authorities there claim to have shot them down, possibly thanks to U.S.-made Patriot missile systems. Throughout the war, we have occasionally checked in with Ian Kelly, the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. He has deep experience in the region, having begun his career in the U.S. Foreign Service in the last years of the Soviet Union. He later worked with NATO and was director of the Office of Russian Affairs in Washington. President Obama named him ambassador to Georgia. Ambassador Kelly, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Listeners, as ever, you are welcome to join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you have a question or a comment about the war in Ukraine, this is your chance. Again, 800-222-9455. All right, Ambassador Kelly, so big picture, what is the state of this war as you see it today?
Well, I think, you know, as you suggested in your lead up, I think we're all anticipating an offensive by the Ukrainian forces. And I think that Russia is digging in for that. And it seems to me that what the Ukrainians need to avoid is a stalemate, because I think that's exactly what Putin wants, is to have pressure put on Ukraine. If the stalemate goes on, we have kind of a Western front from World War I situation where the line doesn't really move. There will be more and more pressure on Ukraine to at least have some kind of ceasefire negotiation. And this is not in Ukraine's interest, I don't think, to have a what we used to call a frozen conflict on about nearly 20% of his territory. So I think what Ukraine needs to do is utilize some of the more effective maneuverable weapons that the West has provided. And of course, Ukraine has been trained in NATO tactics of a more maneuverable war rather than slugging it out, across no man's land with artillery, which seems to be Russia's preferred means of fighting war. There's a lot of speculation going on about when this will happen and where it will happen, and of course how effective it will be. But it does seem to be that, as President Zelensky said, they are still waiting for some more weapons to be able to have an effective offensive.
Are you willing to engage in some of that speculation about the prospects for this offensive?
Well, I was 33 years in the Foreign Service, and a big part of that was as a press officer. And of course, we were it was drilled into us not to speculate. However, I'm no longer in the State Department, so I guess I'm free to speculate. I think this is being motivated, I think, as much for political reasons, you know, this idea of a major offensive for political reasons, both internal and external, than for any other reasons. I think there's a lot of expectation among the Ukrainian population that the Ukrainian armed forces will be able to bring this horrible, bloody and grinding war to a quick conclusion. And I think Ukrainians see only a military solution for this too. They do not want to have what is the situation in the country that I used to be assigned to in Georgia, where you have a stalemate, a frozen conflict, and basically a loss of 20% of Georgia's territory because of a understandable failure by the small country of Georgia to be able to push Russia out. I think that this feeling that there's only a military solution is also being fueled by the experience that Ukrainians have suffered under occupation by Russian forces. There have been accusation of war crimes, of course, in a suburb of Kyiv, Bucha. There have been these stories of children in the occupied areas being shipped against their will, sent to Russia, basically to be re-educated as Russians, not as Ukrainians. And of course, Putin and the woman responsible for this program have been indicted by the International Criminal Court for possible war crimes. So I think they know that, and certainly Zelensky knows that settling for some kind of ceasefire that would have kind of World War I type lines and a no man's land is not in Ukraine's interest. And that's also why they are so interested in having the kind of weapons that NATO uses in their doctrine for fighting a war like this, which is maneuverability, using armored weapons to attack the enemy.
The journalist Anne Applebaum has a cover story in the June issue of the Atlantic magazine, and you've talked about this need, or the Ukrainian view of a need for a military victory, really, not a stalemate. But she reports that some Ukrainians are quietly worried that the United States doesn't really want them to win, right? They want them to maybe take back some territory, come to a draw, not inflict a real defeat on Russia, such as taking back Crimea or destroying the Black Sea Fleet. What do you think of that?
I think some of that fear is founded when it comes to Crimea. I do think that there are people, senior officials in the administration who fear that any kind of attack on Crimea, which of course was illegally annexed 9 years ago by Putin, and is really kind of heralded as historically Russian territory. I do think that there is a fear that if in Washington, that if Ukraine does try to take Crimea, that it will trigger a broader war and use of the kind of weapons nobody wants to see on the battlefield. I think when it comes to liberating the area that first of all Russian proxy forces occupied starting in 2014 and around the towns of Luhansk and Donetsk, and then the shoulder areas around those around that those two cities to the north and to the southwest. I think that there's a pretty much acceptance that that's fair. That's fair game. That Ukraine should have the ability to do that. I think there's also a anxiety, I think, among Europeans and among many Americans too about 2024, about the staying power of the U.S. to have this very robust security assistance program if the election goes a different way in 2024. So, in a war like this, there's going to be a lot of anxiety. But I don't think it's well placed when you talk about the area that Russia has taken over to the north of Crimea and to the east of Crimea. Crimea itself, I think a lot of people see in a different category. Whether that's proper or not, I don't think it is. But
interesting,
it is.
I heard Ann Applebaum refer to it as basically Russia has turned it into like an aircraft carrier off the southern coast of Ukraine. And basically it's a staging ground for military operations. Do you think the U.S. should step in to try and, if the Ukrainians, sort of roll on, they've had a lot of surprising success, or at least surprising to some of the pundits, throughout this war, if they sort of roll on, should the U.S. try to stop them short of going for Crimea?
Fortunately, I don't have to make that decision. I don't think they should. I understand that, President Biden has said his main priority is not to start World War III. So I understand the concern there. But I think that the metaphor of an aircraft carrier from which Ukrainian sites are being bombed and Ukrainians are being killed from the air. That's a really appropriate metaphor. And I do think that targets in Crimea are fair game. And this is why I think we really should support the a provision of longer range artillery. I mean, to date, we have given them the kind of artillery that has a limited range. It's great in a tactical sense, to kind of shape the battlefield, but it can't reach in deep into territory to hit strategic targets. And I would say that any air base, any missile site, any ships that are launching missiles against the Ukrainian population should be fair game. So I do disagree with the administration in that respect. I think we should give them that. I think I think it is a concern that Putin would see any kind of Ukrainian ground attack on Crimea, attempt to take over the territory and push out Russians. I think Putin would see that as a real provocation. Necessitating a real strong response.
That's interesting. We need to take a break in a couple minutes. Just remind listeners, we're talking with Ambassador Ian Kelly. He's the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University, but was a career foreign service officer, culminating with being ambassador to Georgia, and has deep expertise in Eastern Europe. Before we take a break, you mentioned this sort of the fear about the longer term, I guess the medium term prospects of U.S. support for Ukraine, right? People seem to be pretty confident for this year, but then we have the 2024 elections. We don't have to wonder. At that CNN town hall last week, former President Trump claimed he would end the war, but did not commit to helping Ukraine if he is elected again next year. Can you just speak briefly on that for about a minute, then we have to take a break?
Yeah, I think that's the main fear, is that you'd get a president in there who would not commit to continuing this this robust program of assistance. I think the other fear is that the makeup of Congress would change, where you would have. I mean, up to now, we've had bipartisan support in both the House and in the Senate. But if the elections go more towards isolationism, more toward Trump's point of view, then we can't, you know, we wouldn't be able to do it, because Congress has to appropriate the funds for it.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, more with Ambassador Ian Kelly on the situation in Ukraine. If you want to join us, and we have callers on the line, stay with us. We'll get to you after the break. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can send an email. talk@21stshow.org is our address. This is the 21st Show. Do stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about Russia's war against Ukraine, the U.S.'s role in supporting the Ukrainians' defense of their country in that, and all the related issues that this brings up. We're talking about this with Ian Kelly, ambassador in residence at Northwestern University, and before that, a longtime State Department official. He began in serving in the Foreign Service during the last years of the Soviet Union. His career culminated with being ambassador to Georgia. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. And let's go now to line one. Paul is calling in from Urbana. Paul, thanks for the call.
Hi, thank you for taking it. I sent the text of the Eisenhower Media Network's full-page ad in the New York Times today, "The U.S. should be a force for peace in the world." I was going to ask the ambassador to react to that. But then you were talking about Crimea. There are two unique things about Crimea and the contested areas in Georgia, which you're quite familiar with, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. They were both given to those polities by Imperial, well, Soviet diktat. Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine, and the latter two territories were given to Stalin's favorite country, his fatherland, where he was from, mainly for pork. But those people there have nothing to do with the Georgian culture. I believe it's South Ossetia, where they speak a Farsi and Iranian language. So there's a lot of hypocrisy, I think, in the U.S.'s stance overall. I think John Mearsheimer would help. Perhaps you could host a debate between this gentleman and John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago. I've been urging you to have him on for a bit.
All right, Paul. Well, let's let the ambassador respond to what you said. Thank you for the call in. We appreciate it. Ambassador Kelly, I don't know if you want to take those things. Take it where you will. Yeah.
Sure. You know, I think there's a couple of important principles that Russia has violated in annexing Crimea and in basically carving out those two areas you mentioned, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which in fact did have a different ethnic makeup. And you know, one issue, I think, is no changes of borders by force. And I mean, this is the way that World War II started. It's the way that World War I started. And there had been a kind of a post-war consensus right up to, I'd say, the last 10 years or so, that there would be a political process to talk about changes of borders, but that larger powers should not be able to change borders by threat or by force. So that's one aspect of it. I think the other aspect is the non resident ethnic populations have been suffering a lot of persecution. And in the case of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, there was mass use of violence to ethnically cleanse all Georgians from those two places, particularly in the case of Abkhazia, where there were hundreds of thousands of Georgians who'd been there for generations. It's true the Abkhaz are a different ethnic group, but they weren't the majority in Abkhazia. There actually were more Georgians living there. So this is what I think unites both Europe and the United States, the idea that we need to defend this principle of no changes of borders unilaterally by force. And that's what Russia has done in both cases.
You think the U.S. made a mistake in 2014 in not, I mean, I don't know if it's fair. I'm curious if you think it's fair to say that, you know, we essentially allowed Russia to invade and annex Crimea, and not pushing back further at that time?
Well, it wasn't in our, it wasn't in our power really to, we did push back, but we pushed back rhetorically. We did not provide them with the Ukrainians with the kind of weapons that they would need to be able to resist the Russian takeover, particularly in Crimea. So, I mean, that was one of the reasons why Russia was able just to kind of roll over Crimea and then roll over Donetsk and Luhansk. The situation is quite different now. In 2014, you had the elected president, a guy named Yanukovych. He fled the country, and so the country was under an interim government. The Ukrainian military was really not prepared for any kind of invasion. Probably, I think, a lot of Ukrainians would say it was probably a mistake that, not to resist the takeover of Crimea. The takeover of Crimea was bloodless. Basically the Ukrainian forces there just let them have the bases. They didn't shoot back. In the case of Donetsk and Luhansk, they did shoot back. And that was the kind of low simmering conflict that started in 2014, right up to last year.
As we are looking ahead, so we've talked about a little bit about what the Ukrainian vision of victory would be it the borders as they existed last year, at the beginning of last year, or maybe even before this 2014 invasion in Crimea. What about justice and reparations? You mentioned the war crimes, I guess not prosecutions, but charges, if you will. What do you see as what Ukrainians want and what might be achievable in terms of the, the sort of justice for what they've experienced?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yesterday, in one of my classes at Northwestern, I invited a Ukrainian scholar who's resident in Northwestern this quarter, and we talked about this very issue, and he said that Ukrainians believe very, very firmly that there needs to be justice for some of these atrocities, and the main atrocities or the main crimes that they had in mind are some of the summary executions, of course, and torture in Bucha, in this suburb of Kiev, and the other is the forcible evacuation of Russian children from the occupied areas. So that's That is a, you know, a, I think an absolute necessity for Ukrainians. And the other thing is the, you know, who pays for their reconstruction? There's been so far about $150 billion worth of infrastructure damage and destruction, there are Ukrainians are proposing that some of this come out of the funds that have been frozen by the sanctions. I'm not sure what that exact figure is, but it's close to that number. You know, about $150 billion. The entire GDP of Ukraine is $200 billion, so they obviously can't pay for their own reconstruction.
Interesting. What about security membership for Ukraine, right? And maybe this is a time we can, Paul, who called in earlier, also mentioned that New York Times ad from this Eisenhower Media Network. I'll just say, from some of our own producers doing research on this, the Eisenhower Media Network has been accused of echoing Kremlin propaganda lines, you know, sort of blaming NATO expansion for the outbreak of this conflict. But what about some sort of future security membership, either, you know, maybe NATO or maybe just something more ad hoc for Ukraine?
Yeah, I haven't seen this Eisenhower Media Network advertisement. I'll have to look it up. I think it's absolutely critical, especially for the Ukrainians, but I think for the long-term security of Central and Eastern Europe, that there be put in place some kind of security guarantees for Ukraine, that their territorial integrity will be respected. There is some interest in the Chinese proposal, and one of it was retaining the territorial integrity of Ukraine. But there needs to be some kind of really credible legal deterrence that Putin's, if he agrees to withdraw this time, that he won't come back.
Well, that's the concern with like a ceasefire or a stalemate, right? Because then maybe you're just postponing by 2 years the next round of this long war.
Yeah, and that's why they don't want to have necessarily a ceasefire. They want to just press on to a military victory. It doesn't have to be NATO. You could have a number of countries, have some kind of configuration of countries in the region who would provide the kind of guarantee, you know, attack on one is an attack on all, which is the essence of the NATO Article 5. You know, it's very difficult to get consensus from, I think it's 31 countries now in NATO. But if you could get a smaller subset who would agree to guarantee the security, guarantee the borders of Ukraine, that might be something that could lead to, you know, a more stable peace or a more stable ceasefire.
I'm going to, and I should remind listeners, we're speaking with Northwestern University's ambassador in residence, Ian Kelly, about the situation in Ukraine. If the Ukrainians are successful in sort of really delivering a stinging military defeat to Russia, which I've heard described as needing to convince the Russians or maybe just Putin that this was really a mistake that should not be attempted again. What are the downstream consequences of that, right? Lukashenko in Belarus maybe is a potential domino. I don't know if Poland, we've seen a lot of, you know, the rise of authoritarians across Eastern Europe, different places there. But I've even heard speculation that maybe Venezuela and Iran, governments that have close ties to Russia, could face downstream consequences from a Russian defeat. What do you think of that?
This is why it is so difficult for me to imagine Putin agreeing to any kind of, locking in loss of territory that he has claimed, because he knows that if that happens, and if he throws in the towel after saying that this is an existential issue, that Ukraine is part of Russia. We need to bring it back into Russia. It's hard for me to see that he would agree to that, because it is an existential issue for him. A lot of people think it's just Putin calling the shots here, but there is quite a fire-breathing group around him too in the security services, who want to push on, until they get some sort of regime change in Ukraine, or a change, radical change in their policy. And as you say, there will be downstream consequences for Russian influence, particularly in the former Soviet space, if he is defeated in Ukraine. I mean, he's got other interests besides Ukraine. I mean, you mentioned Belarus, Kazakhstan is an important partner, and they're showing more signs of independence. So yeah, it would be politically catastrophic if he's defeated. And that's why this situation, I think, is dangerous.
Just a couple of minutes left. Do you see something positive coming out of this for just the global push for democracy activists around the world? You know, we've had these rise of authoritarian or authoritarian curious presidents everywhere from, as I mentioned, Hungary, Poland, Turkey, the United States, arguably. Do you see something positive coming out of this?
Well, it's had something positive has come out of this in Ukraine itself. I mentioned that I talked to this Ukrainian scholar, and he said that, they have a pretty robust program of public opinion polling there, independent public opinion polling. And the amount of support for democracy, as opposed to, a more authoritarian form of government, has doubled since February of last year. And I think that it also has done just wonders for reuniting the whole transatlantic relationship too, and the need to stay united to help defend democratic institutions, defend countries that are under threat of invasion and takeover. Europeans in particular, they don't want to see what happened in the 30s happen again. And I think that's why you're seeing even Switzerland talking about changing their laws to be able to provide weapons.
Even Switzerland. I think that's probably a good note on which for us to end. Ambassador Ian Kelly, I always really appreciate these conversations. I come away feeling like I've learned a lot. Thank you for making the time to be with us today on the 21st show.
I enjoyed it too, Brian, and I hope we can do it again soon.
All right. Thank you very much. This is the 21st show. More to come after a short break. Stay with us.